You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of Occam's Razor. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This week I was delighted to receive a novel from one of our regular contributors. It's called The Visitor and it stars a detective called Bryony Williams, whose adventures I enjoyed so much in her previous outing in the bestseller The Walker. Both are by Jane Goodall, who lectures in matters scientific at the University of Western Sydney. Her theme, both in the novel and in today's talk, are mystery, magic, superstition and intrigue. Jane.
Who can give soul to an image, life to stone? Truly this secret is not known to the thick-witted, and no one has such powers but he who has vanquished nature, elevating himself above the angels or demons, with whom he then becomes co-operator and can do all things. These are the words of Cornelius Agrippa, 16th century physician, counsellor and judge, and author of several works on the occult sciences. Agrippa was part of the great Renaissance revival of magical science, the goal of which was to enable the adept to conduct apparently miraculous operations, such as that of giving life to figures made of stone or wax. Creating a speaking statue was one of the tour de force aspired to by researchers of this kind. Magical science sounds like a contradiction in terms now, because modern understanding has polarised science and magic. In Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein, first published in 1818, Agrippa's name, along with those of Paracelsus and Albertus Magnus, is a byword for murky occultism, something that has no place in what is called this enlightened and scientific age. Yet to some of the leading scholars in the Renaissance, the words magic and science were almost interchangeable. Etymologically, the word science just means knowledge, and in pre-modern Europe, when most people would have framed their understanding according to a religious doctrine, questing after new knowledge about the created world could be rather suspect. Things understood according to the word of God were revealed to you, and the work of creation was revealed to your senses. Any form of knowledge that had to be earnestly sought after was by definition hidden. A landmark study of magnetism, published in 1600 by Queen Elizabeth's physician William Gilbert, begins with a statement about the discovery of secret things and the investigation of hidden causes. Gilbert's book was to become one of the foundation texts of the new science of electricity a century later. But writing in 1600, he was aware of the need to argue the case for why things formerly hid in deplorable darkness must be brought to the knowledge of mankind. In Gilbert's time, seeking forms of knowledge that might enable you to perform operations with material objects and substances carried the implication that you were interfering with the divine work of creation. And many people did, unashamedly, want to engage in this kind of interference. During the Renaissance, there was an exuberant revival of interest in magical science. Prominent scholars like John Dee, Giordano Bruno, Pico della Mirandola, and Robert Fludd pored over the writings of the Hermetic tradition and undertook new experiments of their own, based on the principle of drawing down the powers of angelic or even demonic agents in order to alter the state of the world. To Orthodox churchmen, this was heresy, but it carried its own forms of devoutness. The source of magical knowledge was supposed to be a mysterious Egyptian sage of quasi-divine status, Hermes the Thrice Great, or Hermes Trismegistus. He was believed to be a predecessor of the prophet Moses, and to have received his knowledge as Moses received the commandments directly from God. So to study the writings of Hermes Trismegistus was to follow someone who was divinely chosen to reveal the secrets of the created world and of its relationship to the higher spheres that surrounded it. Historians of science often like to speak in dramatic terms about the scientific revolution, as if the foundation of the Royal Society in 1660 was the end of all mythologies of Hermeticism and the beginning of a hard-headed, experimental approach based exclusively on observation and reason. Exit the last sorcerers and enter the first scientists. But it wasn't like that. Members of the Royal Society, including Isaac Newton himself, continued to be interested in alchemy. And they continued to make talking statues. John Wilkins, chair of the first meeting of the Royal Society Fellows, kept a talking statue in his garden and liked to trick visitors into thinking that it was magic. Then, of course, he would invite them to inspect the mechanism. But we must be cautious about rushing to assumptions about how an understanding of technology will necessarily dispel beliefs in magic, as if the two forms of interpretation occupied completely different zones of human intelligence. Since the Renaissance and its secret knowledges are currently undergoing a mass-market revival, thanks to Dan Brown's bestseller The Da Vinci Code, I'd like to plead for some of this fascination to be channeled towards the work of Francis Yates, surely the most important historian of Renaissance esoterics. Yates published three great books on Renaissance knowledge, all of which appeared towards the end of her long academic career. Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition came out in 1964 when she was in her mid-60s. The Art of Memory appeared 2 years after that, and the Rosicrucian Enlightenment in the early 1970s. These works remain unique for the freshness and immediacy of their engagement with the massive cultural changes occurring during the later Renaissance. As we slip back into our own comfortable errors of perspective, the kinds of errors that allow us to think of modern science as somehow having vanquished alchemy and magic 3.5 centuries ago, there's a great deal to learn from revisiting the work of Francis Yates. On this question of magical science versus mechanical innovation, she has some quite arresting things to say. First, she lays out some groundwork. Magical research followed particular methodologies. Singing Orphic hymns was one of them, but mathematical analysis was another. Mathematics and geometry were the primary disciplines of occult science, because through a minute understanding of number, proportion and arrangement, one could gain new insights into how the world worked. So, says Yates, Renaissance magic was turning towards number as a possible key to operations, and the subsequent history of man's achievements in applied science has shown that number is indeed a master key to operations by which the forces of the cosmos are made to work in man's service. Francis Yates died in 1981, so she didn't live to see what we call the digital revolution, a further realisation of her argument. There's a cultural as well as a methodological aspect to this relationship between the ancient disciplines of magic and modern approaches to technology. Renaissance scholars learned much of their maths and geometry from Greek and Egyptian sources, but, Yates emphasises, the Greeks never took the momentous step of crossing the bridge between the theoretical and the practical. And in the Middle Ages, any wish to operate risked being seen as diabolic meddling. The wish itself was suspect. Why would you want to make a wheel turn of its own accord, or a statue move, or a man fly? So before there could be any major cultural impulse towards technological innovation, there had to be a change in the will. The Renaissance revival of Hermetic magic, says Francis Yates, served to turn the will in a new direction, because it glorified mechanical inventiveness. The implications of this are challenging indeed. Essentially, she's claiming that without the Renaissance revival of ancient Hermetic knowledge, the technologies of the modern era might not have got off the ground. Magical science, distinguished from other forms of science, was knowledge that controls destiny. It was about changing the material conditions of life. Giordano Bruno, the Renaissance figure on whom Yates concentrated most attention, presents some further challenges to anyone wanting to draw out a neat before and after picture of the development of modern science. Her book on Bruno begins with a vivid, almost filmic moment from his life. "As I followed Bruno along the Strand," she writes, "to the house in Whitehall where he was to expound the Copernican theory to knights and doctors, doubts arose. What was really the subject of this famous discussion? The received view of modern historians was that Bruno was the representative of a new, enlightened knowledge coming to teach the fusty English scholars which way things were really going. It's true that Giordano Bruno promoted the Copernican view of the universe to scholars in London and Oxford, and became contemptuous of them for their recalcitrant, nitpicking determination to stay with the world as they knew it. He rubbished the idea that the cosmos had fixed boundaries, insisted that all the planets revolved, decried false prejudice, called for the light of sense and reason, and offered the key of most diligent inquiry." Scientists of the Victorian era took up such statements and revered Bruno as their precursor, the voice of the sciences of the future. But Yeats delves into the records of what Bruno actually spoke about when he addressed the English scholars, and she draws the conclusion that he was speaking as a hermetic magus of the most extreme kind, with a magico-religious mission of which Copernicanism was the symbol. So the new science of Copernicanism is promoted through the ancient sciences of magic. Such a combination involves a bit of rearrangement in the mental deck chairs for modern thinkers. The Hermetic doctrines taught that the Earth was only a small part of the universe and was in dynamic relationship to wider spheres. And Hermetic magic worked through the cultivation of pathways of communication with these spheres and their powers. So like the Copernican picture, it offered an expanded sense of possibility, a larger mental universe for human beings to inhabit. Giordano Bruno fell foul of the Inquisition and was burned at the stake in 1600 after a long period of imprisonment. 14 years after his death, the followers of Hermetic knowledge received a blow more devastating than anything the Inquisition could deliver to their cause. The scholar Isaac Casaubon identified chunks of later material in the Hermetic texts, and his analysis of the language also proved that they could not have preceded the time of Moses. Rather, they were probably written sometime in the Middle Ages. Perhaps then, the decline of magic had as much to do with the work of a textual critic as with the discoveries made by experimental scientists. Some more rearranging of the deck chairs. Fascination with esoteric knowledges, though, continued with the invention of a new secret prophet, Christian Rosenkreutz, whose followers called themselves Rosicrucians, and organised an invisible college to parallel the new colleges of science being established in the later 17th century. And if the Da Vinci craze is anything to go by, the drawing power of esoteric knowledge continues. Any culture that develops a superior insight complex about its own past risks becoming blind to large dimensions of thought. The great forward movements of the Renaissance, says Francis Yates, all derive their vigour, their emotional impulse, from looking backwards.
A sense of history, a warning to the neophiliacs. Jane Goodall lectures in the history of ideas and much else at the University of Western Sydney. Her latest thriller, highly recommended, is The Visitor, published by Hodder. Next week, Dr. Jack Carmody takes some hormones and celebrates a centenary. I'm Robin Williams.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.